persons, counties may choose to adopt more restrictive standards for this use.
You went till the county did, and then it got appealed, and then the county just last week, I think, went back and adopted this exact language.
So if you want to, you have to get approval from the state of Oregon then. So like if Morrow County said, we don't want but three, then we'd have to ask Oregon for permission for
that. We can almost always be more restrictive than ORS 215. We cannot be less restrictive, and that governs all the exclusive farm use.
So you'd go down to three, but you couldn't go up to seven.
Correct. Yep, that's right. Yep.
You can find seven in three.
So I think most people would be pretty happy to have that problem.
Right. Okay, so moving on, bottom of page 78, another instance of the IRS requirements. Those are for farm-related dwellings. Next page on page 79 is, 78 was farm-related dwellings on non-high-value land. Mm-hmm. 79 is farm dwellings on high-value land.
Just curious, is that defined, high-value versus
mm-hmm.
non-high?
Yes.
It is? Okay.
We can do a little primer on that sometime. If it's class 1 and 2, it's high value. It might also be high value in a class 3, 4, 5, and 6 if it has water rights. It's in an AVA,
okay.
Depending on the slope. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you'll live to see a few of those, but it's a good question. It's not...
Seems ambiguous. The language seems
The language
ambiguous.
Does. There's, it's pretty
but there
prescriptive,
is,
I would say,
okay.
in statute. Yeah.
Sorry.
No,
Sorry.
It's a really good question.
So yeah, your non-high value, you have to show like $40,000 gross annual income from the farm. Your high value, you have to show $80,000 to qualify for the home. And so this is just requiring the tax documentation to justify it.
And that was because different counties were requiring different forms of documentation. And we wouldn't share those tax returns with the public. We just have to see those. I mean, that's really something people don't want to share, right?
Yeah.
So, and funny little trivia, that high value and non-high value, that $40,000 and $80,000 was set back in 1993, and it hasn't changed. I'm actually okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people aren't maximizing profit on a farm, but they're sustainably managing it. It gives the local government, I think, a little bit more flexibility. But now, in order to prove that, asking for some sort of IRS.
And this is under the ORS, like it's not us. So at least that's I interpret it.
It's exactly right.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're not asking for it. Oregon Revised Statute is.
That's right, but they submit it to us for
correct.
A permit here. That's
yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those, they want to be mad at state of Oregon.
That's right, yeah.
Actually, that was something I was going to mention too, and I spaced it. So yeah, again, we're incorporating locally what has already been mandated by the state.
Correct.
And in doing so, when we looked at how to incorporate these, we kind of found that balance of, you know, if the referenced statute listed like two or three criteria, we just go ahead and incorporate those specific criteria in here. Mm-hmm. If it referred to like a giant section and said, hey, refer to ORS 213- whatever, we would just make reference and say, see that. Like, ideally, we'd love to put it locally and not make people cross-reference, but we're not going to turn this already 50-page document into 200
into,
pages.
Yeah.
So, in turn, that also allows that statute to be updated without us having to make any changes because
mm-hmm.
we're simply referencing it.
Correct.
So that was factored in.
For someone that was not in background, he's got the new one.
I've been doing this a few months. Page 84, bottom of page 84 was accessory farm dwellings requiring that IRS paperwork as well. Page 88 was pretty significant and requires a lot more work from us. There was a lot of clarification, additional requirements. You'll see often the essentially farm impact statement. If you're going to put a non-farm dwelling, you've got to, or any number of things, but this was specific to non-farm dwellings, demonstrate that it's not going to affect neighboring farming operations in the area. That was pretty vague previously, and now they've gone into some very specific detail as to how exactly you determine that. So this is incorporating all those requirements on specifically identifying those different things you have to look at to justify that it does not affect farm operations in the area.
That's very prescriptive compared to what we had before, which was just that language in black. Kind of make a summary finding. And
It's kind of one of those, hey, I want to put a house on my 100-acre, you know, EFU, and so what? It's obviously not going to affect anything, but, you know, obviously not is not an answer. So we've got to demonstrate that, right?
Picky, yeah.
And this one helped with, like, retiring. Was this the one?
Like conversion of old farmsteads. Yeah, we just did one of those.
Yeah.
I think I actually have one of these.
Oh, do you?
I think that's what ours is.
Or did you do non-farm?
We have ours on EFU.
I think we did a small.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a small. Our house is 20 acres.
Oh, I don't know.
You missed that fight, though.
Page 91, the top of that, was talking about replacing an existing dwelling. And we already kind of had this covered, but we went ahead and added the reference to just to clearly describe what is considered a dwelling, a lawfully established dwelling. So just made that reference. Page 93 is the last change in the EFU section, and that was just some changes to requirements standards for agritourism. Again, they were focused on what's considered to be incidental and subordinate as far as considering what's agritourism. An agritourism event needs to be necessary to support the farm. So they talk about how you determine that as well.
Do we have any of those in Morrow County?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I say we have. I mean, I take that as like a
pumpkin patch.
Pumpkin patch is where I was going to go with it, mm-hmm. right?
We have Blackacre Farm.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
We have.
There's a small one there in Boardman, off of north of Wilson.
Yeah.
Taylor's
Farm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Taylor's Farm.
Yeah.
There's one out of Lexington.
Thank you.
Justin's.
What's their last names?
They're not very big.
Oh, I thought they're not Justin.
They're not like what's the one?
Yes, that's
Pasco.
The Blackacre Farm.
Middleton.
Baseline.
That's a massive.
Yeah, that's operation.
That's the Disneyland of agritourism.
Yeah, they actually make money.
We have a few of those around here that I assume we permitted that way, but it was prior to my time, so it's just an assumption.
And I think the Red Barn is one. Aren't they in an EFU zone?
Oh, on 8th?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if they're in the EFU, but they were a wedding venue.
They were, yeah. They
for
were
several years.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to page 115. This is in the forest use zone now.
I'm sorry, what page?
115.
Skipping forward.
Yep, jumping to
the forest
use. I'm wondering
if we're going to touch on stuff in here that I'm interested in.
We've only got about...
Wait, what page?
Four more seconds.
115.
115.
Well, I have 111
and 113.
Uh-oh.
I'm getting
another packet. Is anybody else missing?
I thought I heard you, and then it just made me. I thought maybe I was crazy.
Maybe it got.
It's all good.
Okay,
I have.
You got your own packet.
So on 115 and also at the top of 116, same changes that were made to EFU, which talks about the transportation improvement facilities and what requirements do and do not apply. And then also back on 115 at the bottom, again, a definition of what exactly a private park is. And jumping to 118, and it was clarification when you are doing the template test, looking at neighboring properties and dwellings to determine if you can place a dwelling under the template use. This clearly defines, literally just defines how you determine the center when you're figuring that area. So they were very clear that the center of the subject track is the mathematical centroid.
So that's in the forest zone. So the background of that is there are a lot of pre-existing non-conforming parcels and forest zones really through it, not like privately owned forest ground, not state or national forest. And that language essentially says if there's a whole bunch of small non-conforming parcels, you can go ahead and build out the rest of those non-conforming parcels if it's already kind of established a pattern, and this just sort of refines how you establish that pattern. It's more restrictive if it's higher yielding forest ground and less restrictive if it's less. And that's just some language, because I think some counties, myself included, you're trying to maximize the flexibility for a property owner. Once upon a time, like a 1 acre parcel could be a long linear lot, right? Well, now it has to be right in the middle. And more or less square.
Yeah, we were talking about that this morning, actually. The Pinland Lake is a good example, or any of those lakes where there's...
Lakes Ranch, too.
Cabins all around, and so if you want to place one, you determine your area, and you say, hey, there's already 10 others, so therefore you're allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm. They still have to meet fire siting standards and all of that sort of stuff. It's just that...
Can't find insurance.
So, yeah. that code change was, here's how you find the simmer.
I know.
Page 136, we are now in Article 1 of the ordinance, which is our definitions section. We chose to put the private park that we discussed earlier within each of the applicable zones, but in this case, they were talking about the, again, going back to preparing byproducts, things like that, processing on farms and considering that, an outright farm use. This just kind of, it sounds like it kind of goes in circles, but apparently it's better than it was. It sort of defines what preparation means and what products or byproducts actually includes. So we put that in our definitions.
Yeah, and you can imagine, I mean, we've had lots of different inquiries over the years. Oh, I'm manufacturing... wool sweaters. Well, if the term, if you're making garments and if you want to be a preparation, you're going to have to tie the wool from those garments to the farm. Otherwise, it would go in a commercial zone, right? So,
yeah, and it essentially says that the whatever product you're preparing needs to be a product of that farm, or I think it says same facilities in conjunction with this farm. Or
on the tract owned by the farm.
Yeah, exactly. So, so that covers all of the code changes that became effective at the beginning of this year based on that DLCD committee and all that fun stuff. The one other thing that we did add in here is if you move to page 153 towards the very end of the packet, Tamara may be able to expand on this a little bit further, but this is the floodplain requirements when the state offered their different implementing measures, interim measures, to comply with the habitat assessments, and the county was given the choice to choose, did they want to implement this, did they want to do it case-by-case basis. The county chose to address those on a case-by-case basis for applications, and so this was putting some sort of verbiage in there, at least as a placeholder, until we can get clarification from actually the federal government, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So just essentially saying that, hey, you may have to file a habitat assessment for threatened or endangered species. So
it's actually a really onerous, ominous, big issue on the coast. And short story, the background, Dan can probably help you more. The National Marine Fisheries Service sued the Federal Emergency Management Agency. National Marine Fisheries said, you need to protect fisheries and not allow development that encroaches on habitat. It was 8-10 years back and forth in the courts. Some local counties and the state of Oregon intervened and said, it essentially put a stop to all development in a flood zone. A year ago, every jurisdiction that has a floodplain, and the local jurisdiction, city or county, administers the federal flood insurance program. So if you're building in a flood zone, it depends on the type of flood zone, floodway. It now, the county was given the option to adopt a moratorium on any development of flood zone to address impacts to threatened and endangered species on a case-by-case basis, and that's the option the Board of Commissioners gave me direction to do. And the third option was to adopt a model ordinance, and the state doesn't have a model ordinance. They're actually still working on it. So there also is a lot of legal and political effort to do away with that standard. So as a team, we said, let's put it in our code, and we use the language development in a flood hazard overlay zone may be required to submit an environmental assessment to determine whether or not the development complies with FEMA requirements. And I'm happy and surprised to say that we had one example that was approved. It's the Port of Morrow's Kinzu property. They didn't have to do a formal habitat assessment for the development because they had already done one to do an amendment to a flood map. So through a few channels, got some permission from FEMA, and the state said that previous flood habitat assessment would qualify for this. So it's not impossible, but it's going to be really difficult and probably pretty darn expensive to do any development in a flood zone. Dan might know a thing or two about NIMS, right? Or NOAA fisheries?
Sort of, but this, as Tamara described, this is a really weird deal, how it comes through this litigation. I think the Center for Biological Diversity appealed the biop that NIMS, or that FEMA used to go through rulemaking. And so the whole thing got drug back. And what you have before you, this range of options that FEMA has presented to local governments, is pursuant to a settlement agreement of that lawsuit that challenged the biop that FEMA produced, and or that NIMS produced about, and it found a jeopardy, it issued a jeopardy opinion, potentially, unless these sorts of kinds of measures are implemented. So FEMA, as part of its settlement agreement, it didn't go through formal rulemaking, which would result in administrative rules that would have the force of law. It sent out a letter to the local government saying, hey, here's what you got to do. And so, you know, to my way of thinking, you know, it's just like a note from mom, this letter from FEMA saying you've got to do this in order for them to meet the requirements of the settlement agreement. So a number of counties have really pushed back. Tillamook County is leading the charge and has challenged, they've sued FEMA in federal court up in Seattle. I think it's been transferred down to Portland, but challenged their authority to require local governments to do any of this stuff. And then the Trump administration came in, and who knows, FEMA's future is very much in question as a regulatory agency. So what you have before you, I think, is a safe option. It certainly is what NIMS wanted the assessment to be, and FEMA said, fine, we'll make local governments do it, and I'm not really sure what the fulfillment of this condition or this requirement would look like. It can take a lot of different forms, but you're not going to have FEMA breathing down your neck if you adopt this. In fact, FEMA may go away, regardless of what you do. So there's a big backstory on this regulatory language.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. That's even a richer background. But we can now check the box once we adopt it. If we don't have the exact language,
So
has FEMA blessed this language?
No, because we've only gone through work session and here. I have to think, when I submitted the PAPA notice, I don't know if I included FEMA. I included DLCD, who is our, and the floodplain folks.
Yeah, they serve sort of as a buffer between you and FEMA, but yeah,
kind of a should I notify FEMA directly?
You know, if you want FEMA totally off your back,
okay,
I would check with them. Will this language suffice?
I will sure do that.
To, you know, fulfill the county's requirements under the pick 'em options.
Okay.
Do we even have to include that? Like, if it's still kind of being hashed out, could we not even put it in there until they make us?
Well, we had to formally notify FEMA of which of those three PICM, the preliminary implementation conditional measures. Can't remember what PICM stands for. And we notified them of that middle one that we would record on a case-by-case basis. The language we have here, I like it because it says it may be required. And if all this goes away, then it wouldn't
be
required.
You can just keep it.
We can just keep it and it may,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
May not be.
It gives all the discretion to the county to, when it looks like there's any kind of floodplain development or impacts that might affect a listed fish species, this gives you the authority, gives the planning department authority to require an evaluation. And that's what NIMS wanted, and that's what NOAA said it wanted local governments to do. So do it. And it gives you the authority, and if there are no fish or no streams or anything, then you can skip it.
I guess I'm just thinking, like, if it's not in there at all, nobody's going to get the idea it's even required. And if we don't have to have it, and we're just, I mean, it's kind of opening the door to, well, you know, you probably need an environmental assessment. But if it's not there at all, and they're going, who's going to, but FEMA's going to come down on us if we don't have it. Is that?
Yes, that's the truth.
They threatened that for sure.
Okay.
And, well, we don't get a lot of attention from FEMA, knock on wood. Some counties like Tillamook definitely do.
I mean, if you look at Tillamook's topography, it's understandable as to why.
For sure.
Yeah, they have a lot of listed species, a lot of streams.
Yeah, they sure do.
A lot of wet
riparian habitat.
Yeah, they do. And honestly, Stephen W.'s help, went through maps, and we went through the ODFNW maps of threatened endangered species. It came down to this: any stream that's a contributory to the Columbia River is potential. So really any stream in the county.
Any body of work.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing is, there was a time in FEMA history, and federal agencies are changing a lot, where all counties and cities were audited every few years. Like, I want to see, if you issue a permit and it's a flood hazard zone, did you do the right thing? And it's kind of technical. And they even, back, I went back to training for it lots of years ago, and that process has been formalized. So people who do a lot of work in that become a certified floodplain manager, so they really know. We have one person, Kim Cutsforth, Kim Coyle. She's the only one I know in the county, and she maintains her certification. So if I have questions, I always ask Kim about it. She's happy to help. So,
Tamara, do you know, does this apply to bull trout? And bull trout habitat? Or is it just
remember.
The anadromous fish that NOAA Fisheries regulates?
Oh, I don't know, Dan.
Because the bull trout's under U.S. Fish Wildlife Service jurisdiction, and that would be something that's not necessarily connected to the Columbia.
When we did the analysis, Dan, I thought I saw bull trout listed on there. It's been a while. It's been a minute since I looked at it.
It kind of should be, because it's an endangered species. It's just not, it doesn't go to salt water.
Uh-huh. I'd have to double check. Good question. You stumped me, Dan. Okay. Yeah,
that covers our changes. Like Tamara said, we weren't itching to do any more code updates, so we tried to really limit it to the requirements that were effective as of this year and needed to be incorporated.
Perfect. Yeah.
Do we have to do anything with that?
No, actually, just your feedback, answering questions. So when we come back in July, when we meet in Heppner, we might not go through all of these. We can just say we're representing what we presented in the work session and take testimony.
Sounds good.
Yeah, hopefully this is,
we mentioned that's the only thing we have.
Yeah, so far that's the only thing we have for July, so it might go really quickly. What we could do is, was today the cutoff?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, it was today, yes.
Today was the cutoff.
And what do we have for August? Just that joint session with Boardman? Oh, we could, if you want, we could skip a July meeting and have a meeting in, because this would be the only item on the agenda. And then we could do this along with a couple of other things in August. And I was going to mention that in August, the city of Boardman has asked us to have a joint work session because they have a transportation system plan. That could be a little bit longer of a meeting. And what else? That's the only thing on the August agenda. When is this update in front of the board, the code update? Let me check right here. It was going to go to the, I would have to change it was the 20th. I'd have to change the Board of Commissioners date, but that's okay. I can just put it out to September.
I have no objections to July.
Okay.
July is a
I'm just going to say, it, I know, for mostly the harvest people too, right? Okay, so we could do...
Monday after festival.
Oh, you will be tired. That's right. Okay, so we'll schedule it for August PC, and then I'll change the VOC to
September.
Yeah, that's easy PC.
Perfect.
And then I did want to announce it. Oh, are we at that point?
Yeah.
We have been asked by the city of Boardman to have a joint work session, and Michaela, help me. We agreed on doing it on our regular August date, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the 26th. So then rather than meeting here, we would meet in Boardman, either at City Hall or at the maybe Portomaro facility. Does that work for people? Well, if that's okay with you, then we'll just change how we have it posted on our website, and then the public notice would reference Boardman.
Tamara, speaking of Boardman, do you have any updates on the, because didn't they appeal the easement matter?
Yeah, I have three updates for you. So we'll figure out August is the joint work session in Boardman, and we haven't, unless they change their mind, yeah, so we'll do it August 26th, PC. Okay, at Boardman. So a couple of things. Do you want me to do those?
Yeah,
I sort of referenced those in the June update. The Boardman land partition application got appealed, so the Board of Commissioners approved it. They removed that easement language. It still got appealed by a Boardman area resident. It went to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And then the city withdrew their application. I know that's